I would see the destruction of these currencies probably within the next year to 18 months, or probably 2 years at the outside.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Is it really possible that the world's major fiat currencies could be replaced soon, perhaps by a hard asset-backed solution? Today's guest expert, Alistair MacLeod, believes so, having made the case on this channel a few months back. We check in with Alistair here to see how developments since his last appearance are affecting his outlook, as well as to hear his latest price predictions for the price action for gold and silver. Alistair, thanks so much for returning to the program all the way over from the UK.
That's my pleasure, Adam.
All right. Well, so I want to get to the building on the discussion we had last time when you were on a few months back, Alistair. But before we do, let me just ask at a very high level, what's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets right now?
I think the most important thing is something which very, very few people understand, and that is the cycle of bank credit. We are in a situation where the major banks are very highly leveraged. And when that happens and things start deteriorating in terms of the outlook as far as bankers are concerned, then they start contracting their balance sheets. Now, the reason this matters is that GDP is actually it's driven by bank credit. It is the spending of bank credit. The amount of cash spend, because you've got two elements of credit in the economy in terms of circulating media. You've got dollar notes and coin, which are token coin. They're not real, they're not real coins. And you've got bank credit. And if you take out the overseas portion, and funnily enough, I was looking at the numbers this morning, you can pretty much halve the level of cash notes on the Fed's balance sheet as liabilities to arrive at a cash figure for the domestic US economy. Now, that being the case, then 5% of it is cash, 95% of it is bank credit. So what happens when you get a contraction of bank credit? GDP contracts. Now, bank credit feeds not just GDP, but it also feeds the financial sector, the exchange of financial assets, the ability to hold on to financial assets. So it does two very, very important things. But if we concentrate on the GDP, on GDP for the moment, a contraction in bank credit to take them back to more normal times, I think means that it should, in theory, mean that GDP contracts by something like $4, $5, maybe $6 trillion. Now, that's a massive hit. That's a massive hit. And that is without anything happening from abroad, because we've got systemic risks from abroad as well. So I think it's terribly important to understand what this GDP number is. It is not a reflection of economic performance, economic prospects, economic progress, whatever the Keynesians and the macroeconomists believe. It's not that. It is actually just the sum total of transactions funded through bank credit. And if you get a contraction of bank credit, you're going to get a contraction of nominal GDP, which, if it doesn't match, because it won't match because it is also contracting the financial sector. So that, I think, is the most important thing to understand. And what it means is that the slide in GDP, which we're only just beginning to see, is going to be considerably worse than anybody expects. This is very, very important. And you can only really understand it if you understand the psychology of bankers. When bankers are confident about the economic outlook, they leverage up their balance sheets. And you can get the balance sheet leverage in terms of assets to equity, you know, balance sheet equity, moving, say, up from something like 8 to 10 times to 10 to 12 times, that sort of move. The average of the global systemically important banks, and I think there are 8 of them in the United States, is around about 11.7 times. I think the most leveraged is Goldman Sachs, around about 13 times. I think one of the least leveraged ones from memory is Wells Fargo. I mean, they've been told to restrict their business, so they're not quite as leveraged as the others. So you can see that to get back to that, say, 7 to 8 times, there's a lot of bank credit got to be destroyed, which will be reflected in deposits on the deposit side of their balance sheets, which will reduce outstanding deposits very significantly. And we're talking about trillions, and that is going to be the impact on GDP. I'm sure we can talk about the financial effect separate to that, but that probably raises a few questions for you.
It does, because those are big, big numbers. So just to put this in context for folks, Alistair was just mentioning there, he's expecting potentially a 4 to 6 trillion contraction in GDP. GDP is about 25 trillion. So that's about a 20% contraction in GDP that you're contemplating there, Alistair. That would be pretty painful, I think, is way too much of an understatement to use.
Yeah.
So you started this by saying this is, you get to know where we are in the cycle of bank credit here. So if we're entering the down cycle where bankers are becoming more nervous and therefore they're tightening their lending, which is going to lead to this contraction that you're talking about, can you just explain for a moment what is driving this part of the cycle? What is it specifically that is making the bankers scared enough to tighten by this much? Is it just the Fed raising the cost of capital right now with its rate hikes, or what is it?
No, it's actually very, very simple. And to understand it, you've just got to imagine that you're a director of a bank and that you have responsibility to shareholders in that context. You see interest rates beginning to rise. Now, we've got a huge great gap between where interest rates are and arguably where they should be, because you've got inflation running at 10% or, CPI inflation. Some say more, some say it's CPI, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's a huge gap. And that's going to have to be closed somewhat, maybe not totally, but closed somewhat. Now, imagine that you're a director of a bank and you have got loans out to businesses in this environment. And you know that quite a number of the businesses which you have lent money to cannot handle higher interest rates because they are, we could be really blunt and say that they're zombie companies which you've been keeping going because you didn't want to write off your loans. They could be merely businesses which in better times thrive, but when they get a drop in sales, then immediately they start running into overdrafts. So when it comes to that sort of liquidity money, do you really want to provide liquidity into an economy which you can see is beginning to turn down because interest rates are going up? The answer is no. The other thing is that quite a lot of your activities, and particularly since the 1980s, have been increasing in the financial sphere. So you've got a lot of exposure to financial assets. Rising interest rates, what does it do to their values? So that's another area which you're probably going to try and cut back on. So all told, this is a time to be very nervous. And if you were caught, let us say, with COVID, and of course, COVID completely unexpected. What happened? Everybody, their sales stopped, their cost continued. So their borrowing increased. So, you suddenly find that you are overleveraged in a market which suddenly is beginning to decline. Now that, for a banker, is a frightening position to be in. So what do you do as a director of the bank? You want to cut back as much as you can. And the thing that was interesting, and I can't remember whether this came up the last time we spoke, but Jamie Dimon spoke at a banking conference. I think it was in the very early days of July in New York. And he said that 2 weeks ago, I likened the economy to being in a storm. I've upgraded that now. As far as I'm concerned, we are in a hurricane. Now, that is the most senior commercial banker in the world giving you a heads up that he is going to start contracting his balance sheet. Do not ignore that. And nor will all the cohort of bankers around the world. They will know exactly what he said. And if they hadn't already arrived at the same conclusion themselves, they have been told by Jamie Dimon that this situation is getting worse. Therefore, contract your balance sheets. It is inevitable. And this is the cycle of bank credit. I mean, you know, we've had this ever since records really began. It was particularly violent in the first half of the 19th century. It smoothed out a bit after the 1844 Bank Charter Act, which was a major piece of legislation. Of course, this is the thing which led to the post-war slump. It led to the 1930s. I mean, this happens every 10 years on average. And we are now, what, 13, 14 years since the last slump, the last bank credit cycle downturn, which was essentially financial in nature, and that led to the Lehman failure. So, you know, it's time we had another one, I'm afraid. And if you are a director of a bank, you will be very aware of all these dynamics and you will feel very, very exposed. And furthermore, where you have counterparty risk to the Eurozone and the Japanese financial markets, you will know that they're your counterparties in those markets are even more highly leveraged than you are. I mean, it's an average of the G-SIB's average in the Eurozone is around about 20 times. The average in Japan is around about 21, 22 times. So, you know, I mean, it's just incredible the leverage in these foreign banks. And that's where the failure is likely to come from first. So what do you do? I mean, when it comes to everything, you just want to just batten down the hatches and to hell with it. You know, if you're going to, you know, just get your loans in as much as you can, cut your deposit base as much as you can, reduce that ratio of balance sheet assets to equity, and protect your shareholders.
All right. So on that, and I just want to mention another recent quote by Jamie Dimon, which adds further weight to what you're saying. He's recently said that, quote, something worse than a recession may be on its way here, right? So he's talked about the economic hurricane. He's now saying we should all be really concerned about a recession coming, but maybe even something worse than that. So given that level of pessimism, that level of storm alert warning, are we beginning to see in the actual data these deleveraging steps on behalf of the banks? Is that already beginning to appear in the data that you monitor?
It's only really evident in slowing down of the growth. I'm talking sort of worldwide rather than specifically. The slowing down in the growth of broad money supply, which is comprised basically of bank credit and everything which is slightly more liquid. Yes, we are seeing signs of it slowing down, but we haven't yet really got the signs that this is really going to crash. But I have no doubt that in my own mind that that is the direction in which it's going. And I was interesting you quoting that other statement from Jamie Dimon about this could be a bit worse than recession. What your viewers may not know is that following his hurricane comment, his chief economist came out and said to the contrary, that the bank did not expect things to deteriorate. I can't remember the word, but basically what he was doing was he was rowing back on his boss's statement. My guess is that the Fed, shock, horror, we can't have Jamie saying this. Right. This is going to kill us all. For God's sake, get onto the bank and get them to issue a denial. And I think that was the denial. That was the thing. So what he's now saying is not hurricane, he's saying recession. He's had his knuckles wrapped by the Fed. I feel pretty sure of that, because they're going to be very, very sensitive to this sort of thing.
I guess so. But, you know, when your brain says what's worse than a recession, you know, then it pretty quickly goes to depression, which is something I don't think the Fed wants people worrying about right now, too. But we'll see. So real quick, you know, so you would think that banks would tighten lending policies, meaning they'd be letting fewer loans, they'd be making fewer loans right now, given their concerns. You would think they would probably be trying to call any loans that they could, right? Yep. Just they're not having them out there. I guess this is the type of behavior that you're expecting to see a lot more of over the coming months, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. In fact, you can see it already in the figures issued by NASDAQ on margin debt for financing financial positions or positions in financial assets. I mean, that has been contracting very sharply in recent months. So it is already happening in that sphere, and that doesn't surprise me.
Sorry to interrupt on that, but that could contract for two reasons. It could contract because people just don't want to make margin loans anymore because they're becoming less speculative. My guess is, don't let me put words in your mouth, but I would think you, and I do too, I don't think speculation has flushed out of the market as much as that it would cause a downturn in that, because we're still having things like what happened at Bed Bath & Beyond this past week. I mean, the speculative money is still out there. So the other way that it comes down is the banks are just willing to make less margin loans. And so the old ones roll off. And since no new ones are being made, the margin loan balance starts coming down. So it's probably more like that. Is that what you'd think?
Yeah. I mean, it's really sort of understanding, what makes people reduce their loan positions. I mean, basically, when you've got a really frothy market and everybody's bullish, it's not the people taking profits, because actually their psychology is we want more. Right. So, inevitably what happens at the top of a market like that, when the loan books start contracting, is that it is the banks driving it, not the punters. And I mean, obviously it's not a pure argument. I mean, there's a bit of both, obviously, but I would say that overwhelmingly the banks, the brokers would be pulling in loans rather than the reverse. And so when you see sort of positions beginning to go sour, I think that they would tend to act very, very quickly on the margin in order to try and close positions down. So it's an interesting question, because we tend to think of margin loans only really being on the bull tack. But we do know that hedge funds have been shorting it and have recently been squeezed, which is why the equity market has been so strong in the last month or 6 weeks. So, either way creates a loan situation which would be reflected in the NASDAQ figures.
Okay. So, in the world up until just now, the regular mindset would be, okay, banks are getting nervous. They're going to start tightening, and maybe there's a danger of GDP contracting. But don't worry, because the Fed is just going to step in, and the other major central banks, and they're just going to start flooding the world with stimulus again. I assume inflation is the big differentiator this time around, that they just can't step in and do that while we have near double-digit CPI. Is that the big limiter here?
That's a very good question. We'll know the answer once events evolve. But because the Fed's mandate basically is to try and maintain, as one of its two mandates, reasonably full employment, and because undoubtedly the government doesn't want to see a slump, a recession, whatever we call it, then any severe contraction in bank credit is bound to be met by raw currency being injected into the economy. Now, I would guess that the easy way for the Fed to do that would be through financing an increased budget deficit. So I would see government programs to support the economy, if you like, all that sort of rubbish, because they can't actually make the decision what is worth supporting and what isn't, because it's a commercial decision. They are not in a position to make commercial decisions. But I think that's the way in which it would happen. So instead of quantitative tightening, I think that would very rapidly be replaced by quantitative easing, because they will want to maintain a constant level of money, currency, if you like, credit, which is GDP. And one way to do that is to get the government to effectively increase its spending, which, of course, it can finance through QE, or it can finance in terms of short-term debt, which investing institutions will still be very happy to buy because they see it as a safe haven.
All right, but let's just look at your country that you're in right now, the UK, right? So right now, inflation, I think, is what, yeah, I think CPI there is 10.1% right now, right? And just this morning, there was a Citi report that came out where the analyst was predicting 18% CPI by January in the UK. And that's under current status quo conditions, right? Where rates are being hiked. So let's say the rest of the year, the wheels really start to come off, GDP starts contracting, maybe CPI comes down a tiny bit, but then you have the banks stepping in to try to fill this massive hole that you just mentioned might be opening up beneath them. What happens to the CPI in the UK if it's already starting at, like, say, 15% when the next wave of stimulus goes out?
Well, I mean, they have got a hell of a problem. I mean, they set all this off basically by massive deficit spending on the back of COVID. COVID was the excuse, if you like. But now we have a situation where the Bank of England has completely misjudged the inflationary effects of the price level of all this money printing. As indeed, I mean, you've got a cohort of central bankers. They meet at the Bank of International Settlements every 2 months. They stay in contact with each other. They are in a groupthink. Every major central bank made exactly the same mistake. And if you look at the statistics that they put out, their expectations, they're all going back to 2% inflation, you know, except instead of it being at the beginning of 2023, it's going to be in the beginning of 2024 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a groupthink problem. It's not just the UK. We've got it in spades. We have got it in spades partly because we are next door to Europe, which is another level of risk entirely. I mean, it really is. When you look at the policy problem that the Bank of England faces, it's only got two weapons in its armory. One is interest rates. And I can tell you that interest rates have got nothing to do with managing the quantity of money. And the second one is the quantity of money, which it manages through quantitative easing, a lot more than it manages through quantitative tightening. We've seen a tiny bit of quantitative tightening with a few bonds running off the book, you know, maturing. And I think the Bank of England sold some, small amount of corporate bonds into the market, but that's about it. I mean, basically, they can only go one way, and that is reduce interest rates and print debt. That's all it's got in its armory. We now have a situation which is calling against that. It's got to raise interest rates. Why? Not because interest rates control the rate of money, but for the very simple reason that what an interest rate is it is compensation for the loss of possession of money, one. In other words, you give it to someone else, like a bank, so it's no longer in your possession. It is loss of purchasing power over the period which you part with your money. And also, lastly, it is the risk that you entail by giving it to someone else that you're not actually going to get it back. That is what it's about. It's not the price of money as far as the depositor is concerned. So while the situation continues, we will have sterling under pressure. And today we see the sterling dollar rate go down to 1.1750. I mean, this is a new low for the last God knows how many years. I think it went slightly lower in the Brexit situation. But, you know, post-Brexit, we had a wonderful rally. We went up to 140. And now we have lost a good 20% of value in the sterling. Sterling is not alone in this. It is also true of the yen, and it's also true of the euro. And you will have seen that the dollar's trade weighted has been remarkably strong. It's not because the dollar is strong. It's just it is measured against crappy currencies.
Right.
And I'm afraid sterling is one of them. And it's because the Bank of England has got itself into this situation where it cannot raise interest rates sufficiently to stop the currency sliding. So that's where we are. When it comes to the rate of inflation, I mean, the retail price index is already up something like 13%. So, you know, the CPI actually doesn't capture the whole story at all. And we have got all the other problems. I mean, we're beginning to see mortgage rates rise, which is beginning to impact on house prices, which is extremely unhelpful in terms of stimulating the consumer, that is for sure.
Right.
We've also got another problem, and that is London is the financial center, ex New York, for the rest of the world. And particularly, we clear pretty much all the interbank euro transactions for the commercial banking network, not the central banking network, the euro system. That's all done through London, which basically means that London has all the Eurozone commercial banks as its counterparties. It also has the Japanese banks. It also has quite a lot of the American banks. But London has a huge, great problem insofar as this financial whirlwind to which the world is now exposed is likely to center on London. So I'm not hopeful, really, for the immediate outlook in London. I think it's we've got a number of factors which actually could be really rather nasty for us here.
The reason why I asked that question, and I'll dig into it just a little bit further here, which is in the past, and you know, we just saw this response during the pandemic, the central banks would just ratchet it up and do more to try to fill whatever hole is opening up there. But this time around, with CPI being as high as it is, and as you're saying, it probably even understates the real experience of the daily lived, yep, you know, experience of the regular consumer. Will there be limits to that, right? In other words, could the cost of living rise so far, so sharply, so quickly from here, and it's already starting from a very high base, that the public starts really pushing back and saying, you know, we'll almost take the slowdown in the economy than we will, you know, our electricity and food costs jumping by double digits every year?
I don't think that's an option in front of the public. The public have to deal with what they're given, I think. Where we go from here, there are two aspects. I'll deal with the easy one first, and that is that President Putin is not done in the Ukraine. He's not done putting the squeeze on Europe. And that means that in this winter, it's going to be very, very tough in Europe. It's going to be very tough in this country. You're going to have a combination of lack of fuel and lack of food. And that's not a nice combination in the middle of the winter. It's bad enough now, let alone in winter. So I would see energy prices higher in the winter. And I'd also see food price inflation continuing. So that's the background against which monetary policy has to be managed. I mean, you know, I'd rather they didn't manage it, but you know, we live in a world where central banks try and manage these things. So that is really what they face. I think that it is going to be incredibly tough. But the second thing is the question as to what value does the average person place on currency relative to goods? And this is a point which was made by Ludwig von Mises, very much against the monetarist approach to the relationship between money and prices. As I'm sure most of your viewers will know, the relationship as far as monetarists are concerned is that if you increase the quantity of money, you decrease its purchasing power. And you know, it should sort of happen maybe with a bit of a time lag, but it is a proportional thing. So if you double the quantity of money, you sort of roughly halve its purchasing power. There is obviously some truth in the relationship between the quantity of money and its purchasing power. But by far the bigger determinant is the use which the public put on that money in terms of its use value. So to give you an example, if they decide to dump the currency completely in return for goods and services, then it becomes completely worthless, despite you know, the changes in the quantity which may or may not happen. And I think that at some stage we are likely to see this played out in quite dramatic form. And the reason I say that is that when you get a very severe contraction of bank credit, it inevitably leads to banking failures. It is the job of a central bank to try and ensure that these banking failures do not happen and they do not impact on members of the public. So what you're going to see is you're going to see the currencies being debauched in order to protect the financial system, if I can put it that way. Hmm. And I've said this so many times until I'm blue in the face. The prime example of this was John Law in 1720 France, when he printed credit in order to buy shares, support shares in his Mississippi venture. And it got to the stage where it no longer began to work. The shares sank despite that. But what happened was that he destroyed the currency in the process. And we have a similar situation today where the central banks will try and keep the whole of the financial system going, which basically is not just keeping the banks open for business, but also stopping financial assets from sliding in value. And now that's going to require enough money printing to either destroy the currencies through quantity alone, or more likely, destroy the credibility of the fiat currencies that they issue in order to try and support markets. And that, I think, is really where we're going with this.
All right. So if I can just tack on to that, which is if the currency is being debauched, that basically means that the CPI is going up anyways, because it's reflecting the loss of purchasing power. So obviously the consumer, the public, is going to notice that. And if they're in an environment where key essentials like fuel and food are in shorter supply, then you would expect, you know, what we've seen in a lot of other countries, let's just take an Argentina or whatever, you know, where people will just rush out when they get paid to exchange that paper for those key limited supplies, which basically just, you know, continues the cycle of the hyperinflation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think that's you've got it right. And I think in the South American context, I think we probably see a better example with Venezuela, which has got the greatest oil reserves in the world. And, you know, guess what? They've destroyed their currency. I mean, it's, you know, you don't need necessarily to be a terribly, you don't get protection from being a very well-off country from the destruction of wealth that modern macroeconomics can wreak.
All right. So the last time you were on this program 4 months ago, Alistair, we talked about what was going on, you know, the sort of seismic shockwaves that the Ukraine invasion, which was still relatively new back when we talked, what the implication of those shockwaves was going to be. And you had said that you thought that it was accelerating the evolution of a new monetary system away from just pure fiat currencies towards some new system that was probably likely going to be commodity backed. From everything you're saying here right now, it sounds like the acceleration of the purchasing power debauchery in the major fiat currencies you see is it's game on from here on. I guess it's been 4 months since we last talked. You're seeing these developments that we've just been talking about here. Do you still think it's headed towards some sort of new replacement monetary system and one that does have a hard asset backing?
Yes, I do. We've seen when I last spoke to you, I think it was at about that time that it was evident that a core of nations within Asia, and this was the Eurasian Economic Area, which is really comprised of Belarus and various stans in the middle, sort of between China and Russia, also including Russia and China, were trying to set up a currency which would be used for trade settlement purposes only, rather than circulating alongside national currencies. We haven't heard anything more on that, but it is clear the way the geopolitical situation is evolving that that plan is not dead, and they are evolving towards that direction. I mean, the interesting thing is that the whole of, if you like, an alternative geopolitical entity compared with the American and NATO-led political entities with which we are more familiar. And if you look at the populations involved, I think in rough terms, America and its allies, if you look at the Asian bloc, it works out about 57% of the global population. So they're already sort of more or less twice the size of us in terms of people. Now, in the old days, we wouldn't have worried about this because, impoverished nomads who don't really figure in the economy. So what? Who cares? But actually, things have changed hugely in Asia. You've got communications which are being set up, that's developing. Those economies are in an industrial revolution, which is ongoing, despite the problems we see in China in the property sector. That is still, it's still ongoing. And we even see that one of the two founding partners of the petrodollar, Saudi Arabia, the other one obviously being America, but Saudi Arabia is now flirting with the idea of joining BRICS. And I have known for some time that in terms of long-term strategic planning, the Arab world have increasingly taken the view that their future is with Asia and not with America and Europe. And apart from anything else, I mean, we're pursuing this decarbonization thing very aggressively. So that sends a signal to all the hydrocarbon producers right. that their future is not with us. So you can see that, you know, the world has gone into two lumps. There is us, you know, and we're relying on our financial markets, if you like, to drive things. And you've got a commodity-driven block, which is at least twice the size of us, centered on Asia, and also incorporating the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, certain countries in South America as well. I mean, this is enormous. It's far bigger than us. And these guys are all commodity-driven, and they will seek protection from a collapse in our currencies by tying their currencies somehow towards into their commoditized or the commodity-driven economies. So whether they go on a gold standard or whatever in the fullness of time, I don't know, we'll have to see. I mean, I just noticed there is a marked reluctance of every central bank in the world to part with any gold whatsoever. They mm-hmm. seem it's all right for them, but it's not all right for us. So, you know, that I think is a development which we will have to see closer to the time. But meanwhile, the research that I have done has shown quite clearly that when you look at the volatility in commodity prices and you compare the volatility in fiat currencies, which obviously what we watch the dollar price of copper, for example, dollar price of oil, compare it with the gold price for copper, oil, whatever it is. I mean, it's been very, very stable in gold terms. All the volatility is actually in the fiat currencies, which is completely the other way around from where we think. We think that actually it's the copper price being volatile or the oil price being volatile. It's not. It's our currency. It's our currency against those individual commodities. I mean, you know, there are times when the price of oil will move faster than the price of copper or faster than the price of lithium or whatever. It doesn't matter because it's a question of allocation where the currency goes. But the volatility is in the currency, and that needs to be thought about very, very deeply. It actually destroys the whole concept of trying to run an economy on a fiat currency. It's a fascinating conclusion.
That is. All right. Well, look, I want to get to your specific thoughts on the precious metals in just a moment, because that's your sort of your day job is really focusing on those markets. And there's lots of implications about what's happening with those fiat currencies as it relates to the precious metals. But real quickly, in talking about this, you know, emergence of a more polarized world, it's amazing how much of this sort of, you know, happy goodwill of globalization has been unraveled just in 2022 alone. But when we talked last, you had said that, if I remember correctly, that you think that a part of Putin's long-term strategy, especially going into Ukraine, is to really start to drive a wedge between the U.S., Europe and the U.S., right? Yep. It's to put enough pressure on Europe that Europe says, you know what, maybe we're actually better off having even stronger ties with Russia and perhaps this emerging bloc and not being as tied to America as we have been in the past. So it's, even though it's this Eurasian bloc and the West, you know, Putin might be trying to actually carve the West in two, right? And clearly it's got, pardon my French here, but it's got Europe by the short hairs right now. And looking forward into winter, you just painted a pretty grim outlook. And I've talked to a couple of other experts such as yourself over the past couple of weeks who are European based, and they are quite pessimistic as well. I mean, honestly, beyond sort of hoping for a coup in Russia, it doesn't seem that Europe has a lot of short-term optimism about being able to get out from under its, you know, near total energy dependency on Russia right now. So I guess my question is do you still believe that that's the case? In other words, that that Putin is trying to you know, lever apart the U.S. in Europe? And what's your current estimation of his level of success at being able to do that, given, you know, the fact that Europe doesn't have many good near or maybe even midterm options here?
Yeah, my opinion on that hasn't changed at all. That's the first thing I'd say. And if anything, I would suggest that events have moved in such a way that they rather confirm that analysis. I mean, right from the start, we have known that Putin did not want to see America anywhere near his Western borders. And that plainly is the objective. I mean, it's not to win, you know, to completely take over the whole of Ukraine. I mean, you could say that he wants to, you know, consolidate his position in the Donetsk and so on, you know, on that sort of eastern end of the Ukraine. I can understand that. I mean, it's the Russian speakers and so on and so forth. But actually, really what he wants to do is he just wants to get America out of Europe in terms of telling Europe what to do. Because in the longer term, Russia has the potential for enormous trade with Europe. It doesn't want to lose that. But, you know, the way in which it maintains it, the way in which it will pursue its objectives, getting America out of Europe, is basically to squeeze Europe. And that's what he's doing. And the squeeze is going to get tougher and tougher and tougher. It's interesting that, you know, on this energy thing, you know, he turned around and said, well, you can have as much energy as you like, but you'll have to pay in rubles. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he turned around to his, you know, if you like, his colleagues in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and indeed anyone else outside this sort of American-led hegemony. And said, we will take your currencies. He was quite happy to take, you know, rubbish currencies from Turkey, for example, or Iran, or wherever it might be. And we will exchange oil or energy or, you know, commodities for those. You know, and you sort of, and not only that, but he's been offering the oil out at a discount. So that this gives a huge, huge boost to the relative economic performance of greater Asia than we're getting out of this situation. I mean, you know, you can see that India, I mean, you know, it's a classic example. I mean, that economy needs an awful lot of oil. OK, so it gets it very cheaply from Russia in return for rupees, which it just prints or is issued as credit. I mean, what a wonderful deal. And he gets it at such a discount that he can even process it and then repackage it and ship it to America. That was the latest thing, which I understand happened. So, you know, we are definitely bifurcating into two separate worlds in terms of economy. And I'm afraid we're in the wrong one. And it's entirely our fault. We've fallen, if you like, strategically, we've blundered completely in mishandling Putin. And I mean, in the early days, there was so much desire for believing that Putin wouldn't succeed or, you know, he would back down and he would be forced to negotiate. Or he was ill and people were telling me that, oh, we think he's got dementia or something, you know, come on. And the vested interests you see in the mainstream media of reporting the Russian economy being in trouble, it's not in trouble. It's actually probably in as good a condition as ever been. And certainly its trade surpluses are at record levels. So what's the problem in Russia? None whatsoever. They're actually enjoying this.
All right. I might want to dig into that in just a minute if we've got time. But real quick, I know you're not a political analyst. You're economic and monetary analyst, but you do live in Europe. And I'm curious if there has been any shift yet in terms of the leadership there in potentially developing an opening mindset to engaging with Putin and Russia to try to find a compromise versus, you know, demonizing him and saying, look, we're not going to have anything to do with these, you know, with Russia, and we're just going to put in, you know, boycotts and embargoes and whatnot. And in the UK, you guys are going through a transition in your prime minister. And so I'm just curious, is the incoming prime minister, is her mindset in any way different from the previous one, or is it still, you know, very, very polarized, Russia bad, West good?
It's still polarized, Russia bad, West good. I mean, okay. Liz Truss is still the foreign secretary. So, you know, she's been pushing the Russia bad thing, as you may imagine. And Rishi Sunak, the other contender, similarly has been pushing the same thing. And I think
that's right. I'm sorry, I assume that she was going to win based on what I've heard in the polls, but I shouldn't do that. We should let the election happen.
I have some advanced information. But I couldn't possibly comment on that. I think around Europe as a whole, I think there's still, I mean, the Putin is the enemy. He is the source of all our troubles. It is due to him that we're suffering from enormous gas and oil price hikes and so on and so forth. So he's definitely the evil man behind this. The problems in Europe haven't evolved yet, I think, to understand that that's not necessarily the case. And actually, the responsibility is the mismanagement of the situation by their own governments. I think that will happen at some stage in the future. But for now, what you're getting is you're getting farmers, for example, in the Netherlands, revolting against the government's plans to decarbonize the economy. And you've got similar, you know, problems throughout Europe. You know, they're all revolting against government policy, their own government policy. They haven't yet started to look at the situation in that broader geopolitical sense. Though undoubtedly, I think that will happen. And I think the winter is going to be the time really when that happens, because people will then start accusing their own governments for the situation, for that broader situation, rather than just blaming Putin. That's the shift, I think, that I would see happening.
Okay. So it sounds like we're not seeing a thawing yet towards Russia. No. But it also, I don't put words in your mouth, it doesn't seem like the populace in Europe is saying, hey, we need America less at this point. They're not.
No.
So no, they haven't. If Putin's goal is to separate Europe from America, that schism isn't visibly happening yet.
No, you're absolutely right. In that context, I don't think anyone is talking about the desire of Putin to get rid of America. And if America goes, then most of our problems are going to go away. That is, I haven't seen anyone mention that other than me and you talking about it.
Okay. And presumably things like that, you know, don't happen overnight. They take a long time.
That's for the future. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, last sort of geopolitical question, and we'll get to the medals. So is there a chance? I mean, you've laid out why, you know, we're having this polarized world evolve, and there'll be a new economic potentially power, superpower, maybe eventually, of these resource-based economies. That said, you know, they're all not without their own challenges. You gave a quick nod to some of the issues that are going on in China right now. You know, sure, India is benefiting from cheaper energy right now, which is, I'm sure, helping it. But, you know, India's got a lot of issues. And Russia, you're positing that they might be doing quite well right now. I've heard other arguments that say, hey, you know, Russia's got a lot of longer term problems, too. They're not a perfect nation by any stretch. Is there a chance that we emerge from this across the coming years where there really are kind of no winners from this, where almost every player is worse off in the end? I don't know. I'm just tossing it out there for someone who's
Yeah,
thought about
no,
it a
no,
lot.
no. It's a very sensible question. I mean, the way I've been looking at it is slightly differently. I think we're going to end up worse off than,
Right.
say, the greater Asian bloc. I mean, China has got exactly the same cyclical bank credit problem. There is a difference, though, and that is that the big banks in China are all owned by the government or controlled by the government, so that they can actually, you know, because the executives in the banks are essentially functionaries rather than profit-seeking directors or executives, then those banks will expand credit if they're told to do so. So I can see that happening. I can see, I mean, we've already had, I think, in the last week or two, two cuts in sort of fairly small cuts in interest rates in China to try and stop the slide in confidence in the property markets. So yeah, they've got those problems. They've managed to avoid the cyclicality of bank credit, basically because they control the banks. But you know, it's got to the stage where it's caught up with them. What I would say is that in the long term, there is the demand for property in China. Of that, I would have no doubt. It's just that the whole of the sort of supply and demand story has just got ahead of itself, and it needs to pause. China still has an awful lot to do in terms of putting an infrastructure around it. It is, I mean, I saw that China has apparently forgiven loans to 8 African countries, you know. So it's in the business, I think, of ensuring that it stimulates or it doesn't destroy markets outside its own immediate domestic sphere. Your comment about Russia, I mean, the thing that's interesting is that the people who think Russia is a dead duck tend to look at it in Keynesian terms. They actually don't understand that if the ruble goes from 150 to the current level of 59, which it has done in a matter of just 3 or 4 months, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So, you know, they think this is, you know, this is shock, horror, ghastly, goes against all macroeconomic theory we've been taught. The key thing to remember about Russia is that the level of taxation is extremely low. And that's actually very good for economic activity. They don't necessarily collect all the statistics which we salivate over about, you know, how the economy is doing and all the rest of it. But, you know, I mean, with the basic rate of income tax, a flat rate, I think, of 13%, you know, God, dream on. Wouldn't I like that?
Right.
You know, that would encourage me to go out and do things. And I mean, other taxes are relatively minor. You could argue that it can afford this because it is such an exporter of commodities. I wouldn't argue against that. But the finances, Russia's finances actually are pretty good. And I would say that they're a lot better than the West. So again, you know, I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect government. I mean, in fact, the less government, the better, as far as I'm concerned. You do have that to an extent in Russia, if only they would smarten up in terms of property rights. And if they'd smarten up against the state's propensity to remove people it doesn't like, through claiming that they owe tax or whatever, whatever. I mean, they destroy businesses. They're quite happy to destroy people and their businesses. That is not good. I mean, property rights should be respected, and that's one lesson that they haven't learned. But other than that, you know, I would say that Russia is in a far better position than many, many Western nations. And particularly when you take into account that their banking system is pretty secure. Thanks to us, we've isolated them from our problems, which I don't think was quite the intention. But anyway, that's the effect of it.
Right.
This banking crisis we face in the West is going to be probably the most severe thing we've ever seen. I mean, it's got the potential to destroy currencies and all the rest of it. So where does that leave Russia and China? Well, you know, China is mismanaging its situation, but not to the extent that it's going to kill the economy entirely. Russia is sitting there quite happily achieving its geopolitical objectives, is the way I'd put it.
All right. Well, good answer to a challenging question. Okay, so jumping off your comment there about what you see coming has the potential to destroy currencies, let's get to the precious metals. Clearly, in the macro arc that you've outlined in this interview here, almost all those things seem like they should be very supportive of precious metals prices going forward, because you would imagine a lot of capital, given the arc you see happening, would be flooding into places where it could at a minimum hide from inflation, or more just try to hide from the ultimate destruction of the economic system and currencies. So I guess if you can give us sort of your latest outlook on the precious metals here, and maybe the destruction of the currencies is something that takes years to decade plus or whatever, so it doesn't happen tomorrow. But if you could maybe also give us what you see as sort of your shorter term outlooks for the precious metals as well. And maybe in your answer too, if you can address the fact that, at least for the American viewers watching here, I know that the price of gold has done quite well in a lot of other currencies this year, but it has been a surprising disappointment to US dollar holders. So what do you see? Do you see anything that could serve as a trigger to change that? In other words, begin seeing gold appreciate in dollars as well?
Yeah, there's so many answers to this question.
Take
so
it
many
any way facets you like.
Of it. The first thing I would say is that gold is money. It is not an investment. Now, what I mean by that is that if you acquire physical gold, it must be with the intention to eventually spend it, not trade it in. This is a very important distinction. Most people who buy gold in an ETF or something like that, they view it as a hedge, maybe, against the declining situation. But essentially what they're doing is they're doing exactly the same thing they do with Bitcoin. They're looking at it, you know, I can buy gold, say, currently at 1736. I think it's going to go to 2000. So I'm going to buy it so I can sell it at 2000. You know, that is not the purpose of gold. Gold is money. It is there to be spent. And to put this into context, as J.P. Morgan himself said, and I think head of in Congress, in a speech to Congress in 1912, money is gold and nothing else. All the rest is credit. And he wasn't stating an opinion. He was stating a legal fact, which is still true today. And that is the way you've got to look at it. Mm-hmm. Now, we are where we are with a number of factors behind it. We have seen in the last few weeks, last week or so, 2 weeks, various senior traders on the precious metals desk at JP Morgan be found guilty of criminal offenses, spoofing, manipulating the market. We saw something which came out from Peter Hambro, who worked in the bullion markets going back, I think, into the late 70s. He stated quite clearly, and he was in the loop, and he knew all about this, that the Bank of International Settlements, following the end of the Bretton Woods, pursued a campaign working with major central banks to suppress the price of gold. The whole reason that futures markets and the LBMA forward market evolved was to create artificial supply to take out demand for gold. And this was a point that Peter Hambro made. So, what do we see today? We see JP Morgan, and also to a lesser extent Citicorp, are the two major means whereby the US government has been suppressing the price of gold. Now, I'm not saying that the price should be any different from where it is. I'm just saying that this is what has been happening. If we see this suppression diminishing, and I think it might be diminishing a little bit because it's no longer makes any sense for banks who have been rumbled to continue to do this to the same extent that they have in the past. They might have to find other means to try and sit on the price of gold. I suspect that the outlook for gold might improve just from the point of view of that suppression being diminished. The other problem with it, of course, is that the longer you suppress the price of gold, the more you give the opportunity to foreign central banks, particularly in Asia, to accumulate physical gold, which is what they have been doing. So actually, the original purpose of suppressing the price of gold was to allow the dollar to fulfill its void, if you like, as the reserve asset on bank balance sheets. That situation has passed. So really what we're looking at now is the need to suppress gold, because if the gold price rises, it undermines credibility in the paper currencies. So that is a different thing. And I think that's why it has continued, but probably why it cannot continue in a sense. So I think that is, if you like, that background. Accepting that the whole point of hoarding gold, physical gold, holding gold, is that it is money and it is to be spent, then if you couple that with the regularity of banking crises and the next one coming up, which we are on the verge of, as we've already discussed, is likely to be extremely severe, what I would see is crisis first, and I would see the reaction in the gold price second. I would put in a slight proviso, and that is that virtually everybody in the financial system, except perhaps the people who watch this sort of video, are pure Keynesian economists, and they're driven by macroeconomic theory. They do not understand that gold actually is legal money. They do not understand the consequences of the public rejection of a fiat currency and how that really does just remove its value entirely. They think that's something that only happens to the Venezuelans. It can't happen to the mighty dollar. And they invest on that basis. So you can see that they are not going to drive the price of gold down. So the first reaction to a banking crisis is probably for money to go into the dollar and short-term US government paper, not gold. And we saw this indeed when the Lehman brothers failed. We saw the price of gold fall. I can't remember the figures, but I think it went down from something like 830 to 680 or something like that. I mean, it was a fairly sharp fall before it then went up to 1920 over the next couple of years. So this is why you should never, ever buy physical gold as an investment, because you will get whipsawed. There are people out there far bigger than you. It is a huge market, and they are on the other side of the transaction. They will shake you out. And, you know, even if you've got a few tens of millions of dollars to put into gold, you will get wiped out if you look at it as an investment. That has been the history of it. But if you have the physical stuff and you just tuck it away and you say, eventually I'm going to spend this if the whole economy goes, as the Australians say, tits up, then that will be the point. You will have learned the lesson and you will have done the right thing.
Right. I'm feeling better now about my short hairs swaying comment earlier. All right. So, you know, in terms of, I hate to ask this in such a crass way, I'm going to ask you sort of about a price prediction here. I don't necessarily need to get a specific number from you, but just sort of in thinking of, we're going to have higher, well, based upon what we just talked about, it sounds like inflation is going to continue to be a concern for folks, right? And that tends to be gold supportive. We may have banking crisis, like you just talked about. Mm-hmm. That tends to be gold supportive after the initial drawdown, when there are margin calls and the financial, you know, sort of a meltdown in asset prices. So I'm assuming, I think you just said this mostly, I'm assuming you think that the relative value of gold is going to be higher in the future, you know, at certain times as the economic hurricane we mentioned earlier really comes into to play here. I guess given where it is right now, what is gold? I think it cracked below, I think it's somewhere in the 1800s right now, right?
Yeah, it's about 17. I mean, as we speak, it's about 1740-ish.
Okay, sorry, that's right, broke below the 1800s. So it's mid-17s right now. Silver, I think, is back down in the 18s. Maybe fast forward a year or so into the type of future that you see coming. How much of a delta do you see? I don't necessarily need a price target, but do you think it could be moderately higher, a lot higher, given what you see coming by then? Or do you think that its day is going to take a while, even longer? I know whatever path we take is going to be a volatile one. You've done a good job of warning people for that. But in terms of when it comes time for those who hold it to be able to start exchanging it, you know, for other things,
goods and services rather than currency. Yeah.
Right. And on a basis that's relatively better than where it is today, how much are they going to benefit, do you think? An awful lot, a little, you know, just.
Well, an awful lot, because if I'm right about this, the collapse in fiat currencies is going to be a lot quicker than that 10-year thing that you sort of suggested. You know, this is something that is now upon us. It's not something which, you know, is in the dim and distant future, if policy continues and they manage to kick the can down the road and all that sort of stuff. No, this is, I think, a lot more immediate now. And I would see the destruction of these currencies probably within the next year to 18 months, or probably 2 years at the outside. And it could be quicker than that. You can't really give a price projection as such. And that's something which, of course, investors love to see, you know, where do you think it's going to go? But what I can do is talk in general terms. What we will see is a collapse in the purchasing power of fiat currencies, obviously. Now, what that means is that, for example, the price of a decent house in fashionable area, let's say of San Francisco or Los Angeles or something like that, will obviously go up, even though the mortgages which finance these things, the interest rate on the mortgages will have risen quite substantially. But in terms of gold, you will find that the price has actually gone down. And it's a combination of the scarcity of gold, physical gold, as real money, being demanded as real money, lead to a scarcity of available gold, driving up its purchasing power at the same time as the purchasing power of the dollar is driven down by the public's rejection of it. We saw this in Germany in 1923, when you could have bought a house in a very swanky part of Berlin. In 1923, you could have got that for $100. Now, in those days, the dollar was exchangeable at $20.67 the ounce. So we're talking about just a little less than 5 ounces. Now, that house today, I would expect to be the equivalent of maybe $2 or $3 million, something like that. 6 bedrooms, decent house, you know, good address, et cetera, et cetera. Major, you know, major city. Yeah, I would have thought $2 or $3 million, something, you know, that's probably a fair, it could even be a bit more. That's 5 ounces of gold. That gives you an idea. I mean, you know, what it was in terms of paper marks at that time, goodness alone knows. I mean, it was probably a few trillion paper marks. But, you know, in terms of gold, 5 ounces bought you that property.
Okay. And clearly that property today is worth an awful lot more ounces of gold, you know, thousands or so, over 1,000 ounces of gold. But you think it'll come back down to that five ounce range at some point?
Yeah, it's the economic consequences of the destruction of the paper currency. Everybody has far too much paper currency. They're trying to get rid of it, which means its purchasing power goes down far more rapidly than the government can produce it, or it can be produced in the form of bank credit. It's sort of just unties itself from that world completely. Meanwhile, the shortages of physical gold, which everybody at that stage will want, because they want to get out of paper. They want to get out of paper assets. And just another point worth making, I mean, basically, in real terms, the value of property in Germany at that time just completely collapsed for the very simple reason that it was costing more to maintain a property than you got out of rents, because mm-hmm. rents always are fixed in arrears, as it were. You set up a rental contract, yeah. say at however many $1,000 a month, and that's it, and that's fixed for at least a year. And then what happens is that you find that, you know, you've got to get the plumber in or whatever, the currency's collapsed, you've got to pay the plumber $1 million just to fix a tap, replace a washer, whatever. I mean, you know, do you want the property? No, you don't. You know, so you can see that these effects are actually, if you just think about it, really quite obvious. The thing that really worries me more than anything else about this is that we all have friends, we have family who are not going to be prepared for this. And they're going to suffer terribly. And that's the aspect of it which really frightens me. I mean, I can protect myself to a degree, of course I can. But it's friends, family, it's the society, it's the links that hold us all together. That is what is going to be destroyed in this. And of course, the political consequences of all this later. It's not going to be a sudden realization that actually what we should do is we should just have sound money. We should limit the amount of credit that banks issue. We'll find some way of doing that. And, you know, let's just get a stable currency and let's just get on with an economy with very little government, just government making the laws, making sure that, you know, the nation has got reasonable defense, et cetera, rather than ability to be offensive abroad. You know, that would be wonderful if people just immediately thought of that. But then you see Hayek's Road to Serfdom and you realize that actually it is these conditions in Germany in 1923 that eventually led to Hitler taking over the whole country and imposing his fascism on the German nation with everything, all the ghastly things that went with it. So the political consequences of this, I'm afraid, are going to go on and on and on. And we're not necessarily, as political democracies, get the right reason for why it's all gone wrong and actually be sensible afterwards and return towards free markets, people standing alone, none of this woke rubbish and outcome without... you know, without long-term ramifications of starvation, energy shortages, and everything. I mean, you know, all the hardships of not having a circulating medium worth the candle.
Yeah. All right. Well, that seems like a great stump speech for your hat being tossed in the ring for Prime Minister here, Alistair. So I want to let our UK viewers know it's not too late to write you in as a candidate if they'd rather have a sound money champion there. All right. Well, Alistair, we've got to wrap things up here. Thanks so much for giving us so much time. It's not lost on me that you said a few minutes ago that you think that the collapse of the major world fiat currencies will likely happen or could happen in the next, you know, 18 plus months or so. That's a very bold statement. And I wish I had more time to dig in with you on that specifically. But we'll have to do that when we bring you on next time. Okay, so for folks that are really enjoyed this interview, would be interested in learning more about you and your work, where should they go?
I'm published every Thursday, sort of late morning, early afternoon, Eastern Standard Time, on goldmoney.com. And there's a research tab if you hit that. So I do an article every Thursday. The one I'm writing about at the moment, actually, which will be next Thursday, is about bank credit and the link to GDP and why it really matters. So that, I think, for people who are interested in what I've had to say, that's something that they might like to follow up on. And I do a market report on precious metals, which is on the Friday. So that comes out about sort of late morning, early afternoon EST as well. And again, this that is on the same front page of the research side.
Great. And you're pretty active on Twitter too as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So at McLeod Finance finds me, and you know, hopefully I can add something to your information or your education.
Oh, you always whatever. Can. And I definitely wanted to get your Twitter handle in there because I follow you and all your posts there. All right. So Alistair, when we edit this, we will put up the your Twitter handle and the links to the, the Gold Money sites. And folks, you know, Alistair does a great job, as he has in this interview, of really giving people the context for why owning physical precious metals is important. We get lots of questions in the wake of these interviews of, okay, well, how much is right for me and in what form should I buy it in and where should I store it? Alistair's company is a great solution for all of that. We have a free report that kind of breaks all those basic questions down for you. It's over at wealthion.com/how-to-buy. So if you've got those questions, go get that free report and then go explore some of the resources that it lists there. All right, Alistair. Well, look, thank you so much. I still have a bunch of questions I didn't get to, but we're already well over an hour in this, more like an hour and 20. So we'll just have you have to have you back on again soon enough. Thanks so much for giving us so much of your time. It's always wonderful to see you.
That's very much my pleasure, Adam. Thanks for asking me on.
All right. And everybody else, if you'd like to see Alistair back on, as well as other great guests of his caliber, please do us a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Thanks so much again, Alistair. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.